Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 216, recorded Monday, September 14th, 2015. Jenny Jardin. Triangulation is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With a built-in HD camera and microphone, you can monitor your front door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like being home even when you're not. Right now, get $10 off the Ring Video Doorbell when you go to ring.com/triangulation. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service that is the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation.
All right. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Jenny Jardin's on the line. I'm so happy to talk to you, Jenny.
I'm happy to be here. I'm sitting here from my Yeti-lined lair.
You look so cool. You look so cool there. You look both hip, artistic, and digital, kind of all meshed into one with the Time Life headsets you're wearing. It's very good.
These are great headsets that your people sent.
Yes,
I didn't have to worry about my hair because I knew it would all be smushed.
It's great. It's great to see you.
Life's too short to worry about.
I would just want to say up front, if I ask anything that's too personal, you just shut me down and say no, too personal.
Okay.
But I want to know about you because we know of you. We've all been reading Jenny in Boing Boing for some time. One of the founding partners of Boing Boing, the fabulous. It was originally a zine, but fabulous digital blog of everything interesting in the world. But I want to go back farther than that. I want to ask why Monica and Glenn named you Jenny.
Oh, wow. They didn't. The name I was born with was Jennifer Lorraine Hamm. And in my teens, I ended up, my dad died. He was a genius artist who was also had some untreated mental health problems and some untreated addiction problems. And he died when I was very young. He died when I was 10.
Mm.
And
that's devastating.
I ended up on the streets at an early age. I had a lot of really rough experiences out in the world when I was in an age that's way too young to handle that kind of stuff.
How did that happen?
I just want to address the name thing real quickly. So,
okay.
I was on the street, you know, off and on from the time that I was like 14 onward.
Shimony.
And when I was, when I was 18, I met a very charismatic man who presented himself as a kind of a spiritual teacher and became part of what felt like a family. And it was I think it's fair to call it a cult. And in that experience, you know, I ended up spending a lot of time in Guatemala and in different Native American communities. This man was Native American, and I accompanied him on a trip to Guatemala to meet traditional Mayan priests, you know, who practice the day keeping and the traditional calendrical system. This man was he was like a kind of Latino Chicano theater person who had found a second calling, basically studying indigenous spirituality. So I went with him to Guatemala when I was either 18 or 19. It was my first year in San Francisco. I made my way out to San Francisco and met him and, you know, really I hadn't had a family for a really long time. And this, you know, a cult can really feel like a family. We went to Guatemala during the war. There was a 36-year civil war in Guatemala, backed by the U.S. The Guatemalan government and military were basically waging war on indigenous people and on students and labor activists and stuff. But it was really a genocidal war, primarily against indigenous people, I believe, to gain control of the land so that things that are happening now, American and Canadian-owned mines coming in and stripping the land of its value, could happen. But at that time, it was 88, 89, the genocidal war was in full swing, and the government was actively, you know, bombing Native American communities, especially in the northern part of Guatemala. And, you know, here I was, an untreated alcoholic and drug addict who was dry, because part of being in the cult was that you needed to be dry. 18, 19 years old, never been out of the country in my life, tagging along with this highly charismatic, very, very unusual man, to Native American villages in Guatemala. And when I was there, I got very, very sick off of, water, food, or whatever. It was in the middle of a war, and we were staying with very poor people, some of whom had just, like the village next door was razed and everybody killed. And we were staying in like the village that survived.
Wow.
I got really sick. And I remember I was like lying in some back room of a hut somewhere, just puking and crapping my guts out. And this little kid, these little babies, it was a Kakchikel Maya village. These little cute little babies were kind of peering over the side of the bed like this, just staring at me for hours. And one of them was this sweet little boy with, like, they call him mocosos. It means like snotties. He had like snot coming out of his face. And he said, "What's your name?" "Tu nombre. Tu nombre." Like that. "What's your name?" And I said, "It's Jennifer." And he, in Kakchikel, the way they would translate that, like if you're a toddler who doesn't speak really Spanish or English, is Sheni Flores.
Oh.
So it was like Sheni Flores. And it was such a cute little portmanteau. Flores means flowers. And my name became Sheni Flores, or Sheni for short. Everybody started calling me that. And it became like the man who is the leader of this cult said, that's your name now. And that was really cool. And he gave me a last name too, because nobody in my family was using my dad's name anymore. It was cool because I had an identity.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's where the name came from. I've actually never talked publicly about that. And, maybe it's too much, but
that's a great story.
I'm also kind of sick of people saying, like, "You made up your name," because it just seems it was so much cooler and more random than that.
it's a wonderful story. I notice you don't want to say the name of the cult leader. How'd you get out of that?
Well, I'm not really ready to talk a whole lot about that. That was all pretty recent. It wasn't. It's just really important for my own recovery to be able to leave that behind. I don't know where those people are.
Yeah.
I don't want to know. I don't want to have anything to do with them. For 20, 25 years of my life, I basically handed every paycheck over to this person. And that kind of, intense control, it was a very abusive, very, very bad situation in many respects. But, I was exposed to a lot of really cool stuff too. So life is complicated. And when you come from a home where there's a lot of abuse and a lot of violence and a lot of unpredictability, as is common in homes where there is, advanced alcoholism and untreated, probably bipolar, which is probably what my dad had. And a mom who didn't know that she didn't have to put up with violent abuse every day. When you come from that kind of environment, your self-worth is really, really damaged. And it seems absolutely normal to walk into a situation where you can count on being abused and being treated as absolutely worthless. And it was a big step up from the kind of crap I was doing on the street when I was younger.
But you just think that's normal. That's the norm.
Yeah, you don't know any better.
And you might even, I think, sometimes think you deserve it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that the reason that, you're getting hit in the face when you do something wrong is because that's what you deserve. You're a bad enough person that you deserve to be hit. A lot of us women who come from homes where that was the norm and that was the way of solving problems, you know, we find ourselves in situations where we're being physically abused, financially abused, sexually abused, verbally abused, and emotionally abused. And it, you know, I'm just super stoked to be out of that.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Hard thing to get out of, though.
And to have a sense of a slowly developing sense of true self-worth. Mm. Like, there's a difference between the kind of posturing that so many of us do on social media and a true sense of deep self-worth. Deep self-worth is something that allows us to give and receive real love and real compassion and really be of service to other people. And that's very different than thinking, you know, I'm because I have 100,000 Twitter followers or whatever, you know, the kind of narcissistic metrics that drive so much of our lives, we who work online.
It's really interesting because my experience of you is as this deeply grounded, centered, rooted person, and almost the kind of person I would say, maybe I don't know you that well.
It's really nice.
But that's
the
sense.
You're so kind. Thank you.
That's the sense you get. And at the same time, you don't think of those kinds of people as being technology mavens and involved in things like Boing Boing and living la vida digitales or whatever they call it.
That's great.
And so you've combined.
I'm going to change my Twitter bio. Living la vida digitales. I'm in a Federico with solar port. Eating my homemade pasta.
Yes, CZ.
Hey.
So it's an interesting, almost paradoxical life you lead. You live a life online, and yet it seems like you might eschew that normally.
I grew up very isolated. I can't get my camera straight. Whoops. I grew up in some ways very isolated. I lived in a home that was physically isolated with two people who were professional artists and who worked in the arts. There was a lot of just intense genius level creativity around us. And
your father was quite a famous painter.
Not famous, but he was a genius. And he wrote a book called Painting the Nude. He specialized in the 70s, like you do,
right.
in painting female nudes. And in fact, our home, one of the reasons that I think I was socially isolated is this was in Richmond, Virginia, which was then an even more conservative and racially divided city, very, very culturally conservative. And here I had this, very eccentric dad who, like, you know how I'm an authenticity masochist with tortillas and soda bread and gardening and whatnot?
Yeah.
He was like that with making his own paints.
Wow.
You know? And we had an antique letterpress printing press in the living room that weighed like 2 tons. And I recently encountered on Twitter a young man who, well, he's like a little younger than me, maybe in his 30s or something. I forget how we stumbled upon this, but we figured out that his dad taught it at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, where my dad was an art professor, or something like that. But anyway, this random guy on Twitter's dad was the printmaker in Richmond that my mom donated that printing press to. Father died. But like, who has a 2 or 3 ton letterpress from the mid 1800s in their living room? And this was small. Like, it was a house that was so dilapidated and so unsafe that it was torn down immediately after my dad died and we moved out, on the corner of a highway. And it was torn down, paved over, and now there's a, if I look on Google Maps, I've never been back there, but there's a big like a Target parking lot over top of it.
Oh.
So we had these like naked ladies wandering around the house, posing for these, you know, beautiful photorealistic portraits that, that my dad would do. And he had all these gadgets that he was building, 3D cameras, cool, you know, stereoscopic players. He was a big Trekkie. So we had phasers and Starship Enterprises. And this was before VCR. And he was kind of a compulsive.
There's his book. I don't know if you. I think that's out of print, but there it's still available.
You can buy it. Yeah, that's my dad, and that's our front yard, which is no longer there.
Oh, wow,
that's a beautiful one of the beautiful, beautiful women that came in and out of our homes. But so he was a big Trekkie, and every night, I hope my little brother Carl watches this show so he can correct me on my. Imperfect memory, but yeah, our dad used to watch Star Trek every night, and I remember him like shushing us because he had a tape recorder that he would put like up next to the TV so that he could do audio recordings of every episode of Star Trek. So it's like there's genius, but then there's this weird sort of OCD, and then he's like mean to the kids during dinner because he's got to record it. So it's it's like the beauty, the nerdiness, and then the wow, that's kind of up all at the same time, and that was childhood.
But what's interesting is
I spent a lot of time roaming the woods, and yet I still care about interesting things, and it just it's a natural extension of, I guess, where I'm from.
And I think that's great because you can both acknowledge the DNA, at the same time rejecting perhaps that life. But you can't miss the fact that that's those are your roots. That's where you come. That's the flower. That's where the Jenny Flower Flores comes out of, right?
Yeah. You know, it takes a long time sometimes for us to come to terms with the good and the bad of where we're from. Right. So for me, you know, I the bad was pretty hard to miss. And I had my own, you know, like I spent most of my time looking back on that saying, my parents were so. It was so wrong. I was so victimized. And then I realized, like, they were doing the best they could. They were each doing the absolute best that they could. And I have my own issues. I have played my own part in all of that craziness as an adult. You know, I chose to stay in the situation that I described to you earlier. You know, made some really good decisions in life, made some really bad ones. And, like, I'm a grown-ass woman now. I get to take responsibility for that. And just as I know that within myself, I am capable of great kindness and great cruelty, great selfishness and great generosity, you know, character defects and character assets, I know that my mom and dad had those same things. And I have different tools than they have to deal with all of that. So I'm just getting to the place where I can, like, I can look at my dad's paintings now. Could for a long time.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, or I can just really appreciate all that, like, my mom did, to raise two kids, after sticking in a really horrible, abusive, isolating. It's almost like being kidnapped for her, I think, and she felt like she couldn't get out. A lot of women do. Definitely a lot of women at that time did. It was a very different time for women who wanted to have careers. My mom was a copy editor. She was a publications editor for the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And she did she did great, great work. It's where a lot of my own copy editing skills and love of language come from. And she was, she faced all kinds of sexual abuse and sexual harassment all her life. And she did her best. So it just, you know, I guess part of it is just getting older and realizing, you know, if I'm this much of a up and I'm trying this hard, maybe I can, you know, give my mom and dad some slack and just appreciate both the good and the bad of where I come from.
They always say getting older, the only real reward of getting older is wisdom, but not, it's so few of us actually get wisdom with age. But I think that you have a very mature and accurate point of view, which is I think we all do the best we can. And it's hard sometimes to look at your parents especially and say they were doing the best they can or they could, right?
Yeah.
But if you don't do that, you can't move on.
Yeah, and for me too, I've had my own lifelong struggles with alcohol and drug abuse. And so for me, coming to terms with the fact that, like, I had cancer, and cancer is a disease, and this other stuff is a disease too, and it affects everyone in the family. You know, some of the experiences that I've had over the last couple of years, coming to terms with all of that with help, has helped me come to peace, come to a place of peace and acceptance. I don't always stay there, and like, I don't always exist in a state of perfect spiritual bliss, but you know, more than half the time, I don't want to kill myself anymore.
Hey, that's good.
More than half the time, I don't want to kill myself or anybody else.
Good. We're talking to Jenny Jardin, internet superstar, but also very deep, and as you can tell, very interesting
person.
So deep.
So interesting.
I want to talk about Jason Calacanis when we get back.
Aw, Jason.
Not many people say that when you say his name. Aw, Jason. But I want to hear about the early days at the Silicon Alley Reporter.
Okay.
This is really an interesting triangulation. I'm so glad you could be here. We're also going to talk about making tortillas. Because you talked me into that a couple of weeks ago, and now I have a 25-pound bag of corn.
Oh, boy.
That's big, you know. That's not that's this big. It came in a giant box, and I said, wait a minute. How much corn did I order? Oh, my God. Well, tortillas for all in a little bit. But first, a word about Blue Apron. And we like to talk about cooking. And Blue Apron is a really, really great thing for people who want to kind of dip their toe to begin to become a great cook. Blue Apron is named after the blue apron that the apprentices at the famed Cordon Bleu cooking school in Paris wear. You're an apprentice learning how to cook amazing meals, always from fresh ingredients. Even the meats and fish are fresh, not frozen. They come delivered to you in a refrigerated box. And what I love about it, it's stuff you probably wouldn't ever think of cooking, like cumin Sichuan beef and noodles, or southern-style chicken cacciatore. I don't even know what that is. Thai green coconut curry. This makes my mouth water just thinking about it, with sweet potato, green beans, and jasmine rice. You'd get all the ingredients. By the way, not too much, just enough ginger, just the amount you need to mince it up, just the right ingredients, a wonderful little recipe card that tells you how to make it. They have dinner for two or dinner for a family. The family plan's kind of nice because it's kid-friendly ingredients, and you can get the kids involved, which I think is a wonderful idea. Look, we all want to eat wonderful, fresh meals. Going out is not economical and probably not the best thing to do. But you get home from work, who wants to go shopping? Blue Apron is a great solution. I always love it when I come home and I see that Blue Apron box, and I know, oh, we're going to have a nice meal tonight. Less than $10 a meal. Blue Apron will send you perfectly proportioned, fresh ingredients. In fact, every box comes with a card talking about the farm from which one of the ingredients came, to the tomatoes or the corn. And that's really nice, too. You get to celebrate local farms. It's great for date night. You want to impress somebody. Nothing better than Monterey Jack and bell pepper quesadillas or seared steaks and roasted potatoes. Each meal, 500 to 700 calories, takes about half an hour to make. Shipping is free. The menus are always new. You'll never get the same meal twice. This is Jason. This is Jason's Blue Apron box. Look at all this. It's wonderful. I want you to try it. We've got two meals waiting for you right now. My mouth is watering. This is hard to do this ad. I think this is my box. This looks familiar. Lemons. Look at that. Here's the deal. Go to blueapron.com/twit. Your first two meals are free. And you're going to, a whole world of cooking will open up to you. And by the way, once you make these recipes, now you know how, and you can do it again and again. And, you know, for instance, look at that. Oh, man. By the way, the beef is excellent. The fish is excellent. They've really done a nice job with this. They do have vegetarian meals if you want. blueapron.com/twit opens up a world of cooking. And then the next time I make it, I'm going to make the tortillas by hand. Blue Apron. Thanks to you. BlueApron.com/twit. Jenny Jardin is our guest. Jenny Flores.
looks really good. I've never tried Blue Apron, but I've heard about it.
It's a neat idea.
It's wonderful.
You know, sometimes people try, I've tried those pre-made meals, you know, but they're just frozen and you microwave them, and it's not really, it's a TV dinner for the affluent.
Yep.
This is not. This is cooking.
And that's really cool.
They have videos on the site, and they show you how to cut and mince and stuff. So it really is like a little cooking class in a box. They don't say that, but that's really what it is, a little cooking class in a box. And
great.
I'm making stuff. I made the other night a, what was it called, three-cup Taiwan. It was a Taiwanese recipe, Chinese recipe. Three-cup chicken, I thought, because it's a cup of rice wine vinegar, a cup of soy, and a cup of sesame oil. Now, they kind of rejigger it, so it's not exactly a cup. There it is, Taiwanese three-cup.
Look at that.
Oh, so good. And now I've got the technique. Wow. And by the way, the house fills with the lovely odor of Thai basil and ginger and scallions sauteing up. And
Look at that. That looks so simple. Sometimes
Isn't
the best
beautiful?
Recipes are the ones that are so simple.
It is. Yeah.
One of my favorite dishes is called Hainan chicken, and it's not too far off of this. Oh, they sent you choice some?
Yeah.
It's such an obscure green.
I'd never had it. I thought, what is this?
Nice.
It's great.
That's one of my favorites. It's like little baby broccoli, sort of. It's almost like broccoli rabe, sort of.
It's kind of
like
bok choy.
Between that and bok choy.
It's kind of like a delicate bok choy. And, you know, one of the problems I have with bok choy is it's so woody. And
this is like stalky, but the stalk is really, really tender like a leaf.
It's so good. And I never even heard of it. I'm thrilled that you've heard of it. And now that's all I ever want. It is the best thing you ever had. It's incredible.
One thing I learned in Guatemala back in those early years, the people that we were with were very, very poor. And it was a time when it was really, there was a lot of food insecurity there. And I remember hearing the phrase carne verde, green meat. And it was like, and that's like greens. You know, there's always greens, like growing in a forest somewhere or by the side of the road. Gelites, they call them in Mexico. Just, you know, some of them are semi-wild or wild.
Right.
But choisam would be considered carne verde.
Yep.
It's good for you.
Oh, and it's so good.
I try to have carne verde at every meal.
Is that where you learned to cook? In Guatemala?
No, man. My mom was and is a great cook.
Yep.
And my grandmother was a wonderful cook, and they're both really into. My grandmother's long gone; I never met her. But my mom wasn't as wonderful at breads and
what
pastries
kind of
and carby things.
Baking, she was a baker.
She's especially good at baking. She also makes a mean moussaka. And
I love moussaka! I make a mean moussaka.
Oh, we had moussaka that she made. I helped her, but we made a nice moussaka for
it's
Christmas.
It's a lamb casserole. It's so good. Yeah. It's kind of like shepherd's pie for Greeks.
For really fat Greeks, man, because they've got like about
a
metric ton of bechamel sauce.
Oh, it's so good.
I got some eggplants at the market this week, and I'm thinking of making a slightly lighter moussaka this week.
I have to be very careful. I have to learn. So I stopped baking because you know what you do when you bake? You eat.
Oh, yes. I do know.
I've been doing this. I'm sure seen the tartine cookbooks, the tartine baking.
Those are great.
And it's crazy because, I mean, it's bad enough to bake your own bread. This stuff, you can't have a life because you have to raise it for hours and then you ferment it for hours and then you're always tending this loaf and then the starter is like takes over your life every morning and night. You're feeding this little bit of dough and it's like for the rest of your life, this is all you think about.
Great.
It's so good.
It's wonderful.
But I can't do it because I'll eat it and it's not good for me.
Yeah. You know, I go in and out of happy obsessions, in and out of phases with different kinds of projects.
Yep.
But for me, one kind of food obsession or another has always been part of my life.
Yes.
You know, when I was younger and really suffering a lot, I had a pretty serious eating disorder. And now I get to channel that fascination and obsession and the kind of comfort that that food kind of represents to me. I get to channel that into a happier place.
Yes.
I get to think about nutrition and how to raise or lower risk factors for recurrence and progression of cancer. You know, I'm a breast cancer survivor. I can think about what that means in terms of, you know, how many calories or what kind of nutrition I'm getting. And it's just, it's like a happier way to fuss over something.
Yeah.
So I'm not thinking about, like, you know, I'm not vegan or paleo or I don't have a food lifestyle that involves sort of a restrictive identity label. But I love going to the farmer's market. I love mm-hmm. growing what I can outside in my little urban home. And I love slowly fermenting kraut. I have some kraut up in my cabinet right now.
You showed us on Twit.
Yeah, and like making yogurt at home, making kefir at home. I have like little mushroom starter boxes that at some point I might try growing. Or like sourdough starter. To me, those little relationships that you described with tending things that are slowly fermenting, like sourdough starter or like the kraut or kombucha or whatever it is, it's like you have to believe in the future in order to do that. You can't be so depressed or pessimistic or hopeless that you don't care about the future. And there's something about just gently tending and nurturing to things that then nurture you. There's just something really healing about that. So The more that I incorporate that into my life again, after having lived a sleep when you die, we've got to make this startup happen.
Yeah.
Got to get that blog post up. We've got to get a live shot. Like all the crazy psychosis of news. You know, it's a living, but it's a very hard living. And it's honestly not as important to me as being happy.
Good. It does seem, though, I've read books that say, in fact, there's a couple of great books about bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember the name of it, Fire. But her premise, and I'll find it, it's Jemison. Her premise is that, in fact, many of the greatest creative minds of all time probably were bipolar. They had a manic phase that they were intensely, brilliantly creative. Yeah. Which would often be followed by the darkest depression.
Yes.
And if you medicate that away, by the way, I'm a big believer, having mental illness in the family, of medication. But you also want to celebrate our obsessive nature, our manic nature. These are where the real creative things happen. And it's a difficult balance. I think you seemed like you found a way.
Well, I don't have bipolar disorder, but my father... I'm pretty sure that he did.
Yeah.
He did spend some time in mental institutions as well.
Yeah.
But he was clearly a high-functioning genius, you know?
It's called Touched with Fire. It's by Kay Redfield Jamison, who herself is bipolar. But I don't mean specifically bipolar, but it could be obsessiveness. It could be, I think, really interesting to deal with an eating disorder by transmogrifying into an obsession with cooking and healthful creation and things. You don't lose the genius, you just lose the destructive part.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's really complicated. It wasn't like one day I said, I think I'll stop making myself throw up and instead make tortillas. You know,
if only it were that easy.
No, it didn't happen like
that.
No,
of course not.
I went through a gentle and gradual process of recovery that helped me to deal with some of the reasons that, you know, I just hated myself and had such a hard time managing my feelings, you know, and understanding who I was and what I needed and all that kind of crap. And once that stuff started to sort itself out, I was able to understand, like, wow, there's stuff that I like and that I've always liked. You know, I like being in nature. I like having a garden. I like baking bread.
Yeah.
I was so busy worrying about everybody else's and how I, you know, had to fuss over and fix and correct everything on the internet or everything my partners were doing wrong or everything, you know, happening in my boyfriend's family or whatever. And once I started, you know, my happiness and my well-being and being of service to the world, like that's the anchor of my life right now. And when you... when all the kind of crazy, anxious friction starts to calm down and you really start to know who you are, it's just a lot more fun.
Brush with death will do that, won't it?
You know, it will, but, like, I've had brushes with death all my life.
Oh, that's true.
No, I really have. And yeah. I don't say that like, you have no idea.
No, but it didn't.
I have suffered more than anybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm really lucky to have found some tools that keep me, keep me wanting to live. And you know, the thing about bipolar, I learned through this process that about, I forget what the stats are, but it's like, I don't want to misquote it because somebody out there on your show will correct me. You have so many smart people who really know how to use the Google machine. But having a bipolar parent makes you far, far more likely to have bipolar disorder yourself,
right,
or depression. And in my case, I found as my cancer, my primary treatment for cancer was ending, you know, it's very common for people who finish cancer treatment to experience intense depression,
yes,
or PTSD and different kinds, yes, of catastrophic mental health problems. It's very normal. It happened to me, and it was greatly exacerbated by a drug that they put me on, that I'm on for 5 or 10 years, called tamoxifen.
Mm.
A lot of women who have to take tamoxifen, uh-huh, go off it because it causes such serious problems, including for many of us, mental health problems. So for me, I got to a point really, really fast where, I wanted to kill myself, and I just felt like I was in this terrible, terrible quicksand that I had no idea how to get out of. And there were things kind of happening in relationships and financially, and all the, your life's a wreck after cancer, fucking wreck. And all that situational stuff outside of me was real, but there was also something in my brain that was, the brain chemistry was terribly off. Tamoxifen, let me see if I can say this accurately. It's like there's a double whammy effect on the brain. So tamoxifen adversely affects brain cells directly, and it also causes in some of us, like I guess people who have brains the way my brain is, and a tendency for depression anyway, as I do, I have a higher risk because of my dad and
right,
other mental illness in the family. So if you've got that wiring, tamoxifen can also cause the amount of circulating serotonin in the brain to be drastically, drastically depleted. So here I was walking around basically without the serotonin that my brain needed. And if that's like an important feel good chemical. So,
God, that's awful.
Yeah, like the short version of what happened, I like to tell the story because I hope it will help somebody else out there. I was walking around every day trying to die, and the people around me didn't understand why all of a sudden I was like crazy, or, you know, just why I looked like I was suffering so much. I knew enough to know that some women that I met through Twitter, through BCSM, breast cancer social media. If you look at hashtag BCSM, every Monday night, I think it's 6 Pacific, they have a chat for providers, for women with the disease, metastatic or otherwise, for their families. So I met some women there who were like, sweetheart, I hope that tamoxifen goes well for you, but this is what happened to me. And they told me horror stories, kind of like what ended up happening to me. And I was able to, like this one woman, her name is Alicia Staley, she told me enough about what her experience was that I knew when it started happening that I should ask for help.
Yeah,
and keep asking for it until I got it.
Thank goodness.
So I went to the hospital where I got all my cancer treatment. I called them up and I said, hey, you guys just finished saving my life and I want to end it like every day. And I think that it might be because of the drug I'm on, and I really need help so that I don't die or,
uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh,
I can't function. And they said, oh, wow, that's terrible. Okay, are you in active treatment here? And I was like, I'm taking this drug that's supposed to help
prescribed,
prevent my cancer from progressing. So they said, well, we'll have somebody from, like, psychiatric services call you back because they provide some mental health support to people who are in treatment there. So nobody ever called me back, and I called back again, and I had
networked
my way. I networked my way to like the desk that deals with this. And the woman on the phone, when I called a week later, was very apologetic. And she's like, you know, we're really understaffed. The post-it note fell on the floor. I'm so sorry. This is very serious. I'm sure you get a call back right away. So I got a call back. This very nice man said, okay, come on in for an appointment. So I came in. He did this evaluation interview with me. We talked about what was happening. I said, well, look, you know, based on what you're describing, it sounds like you're one of these cases where tamoxifen is wreaking havoc with your brain chemistry. We can try. There's certain classes of drugs that help with this. We have to make sure that we get one that doesn't interfere with the enzyme in your liver that's helping process the tamoxifen, the life-saving drug. I'm going to call your oncologist. I'm going to call the cancer therapist that I was seeing already just to help me like continue getting through therapy because I didn't want to show up because it was so awful. And you know, we'll set it a follow-up appointment for like 24 hours from now. I come back and this wonderful, empathetic, very professional man said, so good news, we figured out what drug it would probably be good to start you on. And I have some ideas of some other things that you might want to try, but I can't help you.
What?
And I said, what do you mean you can't help me? He said, because the rules of the hospital state that you're not in active treatment because you're not getting chemo, you're not getting radiation, you don't currently have any surgery scheduled.
Is this a health insurance issue?
No, it was actually. And so I asked him, I was like, is this because insurance won't cover it? Because I'll pay cash. Like, I'll find out. Yeah. I need to not want to die.
Right.
I need to not have my brain feel like there's blackness inside my brain that I can't crawl out of. Is a physical thing. I was feeling it in my skin and everything.
Yeah.
It's
like
Rob Delaney, the comedian on Twitter. I love him so much. He wrote a beautiful piece about how depression feels. And I hadn't really experienced it like this before. And he was right. So anyway, long story short, this wonderful man said, you know, when they recruited me, he was like, this is off the record. So I'm kind of cheating here because it's not off the record.
Well, you haven't named the hospital or the man, so you're all right.
He's a wonderful man. When they recruited me here, the people who began this hospital wanted to have like full service for cancer patients. And I brought all these professionals in for these different kinds of supportive to help the person.
Holistically treat the person.
With evidence-based medicine for mental health.
Perfect.
And he said that was some time ago. And we don't have the resources that we used to have, so there are restrictions. And I said, let me ask you something, sir. How many of there are you here in this cancer ward? This is one of the biggest, most prestigious cancer centers, certainly on the West Coast, if not in the country. I said, how many are there of you? He said, just me.
Oh, my God.
Just me.
Wow.
So he said, you should try to find somebody who has experience with issues related to like hormones and health. Because basically the tamoxifen.
It's an estrogen antagonist.
It's an endocrine blocker endocrine therapy, estrogen blocker.
Right.
It changes the amount of estrogen and progesterone in your brain, in your body, in your ovaries. It just does a lot of weird things that are unpredictable. I found someone who works with women who are going through fertility therapy, you know, where they squirt you full of all kinds of crazy hormones and they're injecting eggs back into you. That wasn't what I was going through, but it was in the same range enough that a psychiatrist was able to look at me and say, yes, he was right. This is exactly the drug that you should try. Mm-hmm. There's also some anonymous fellowships that you should look into, given your life experience, that may also provide you some social support and a different kind of recovery that you're missing. I pursued all of that reluctantly, and come to find out, it all helped a whole lot. I also use pot. I also use cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And that like that's a whole nother conversation, but I don't use drugs. I use very specific forms and varieties of cannabis as a medicine to help with PTSD, to help with my mental health issues. And there's also all kinds of promising anti-cancer effects. I don't believe that, you know, my use of cannabis will mean that I live a long and cancer-free life because of just that one factor. But who knows? You know, it's not making me any less happy or healthy. And I've been able to get off a lot of the kind of heavy pharmaceutical drugs that I was prescribed, and lower some of the dose of the antidepressants, so that I'm in a good place. All of the chemistry seems to be working. Everybody in the food chain, my therapist, my psychiatrist, you know, the other help I have, everybody knows like what everybody else is doing. And I've managed to find a greater sense of peace and serenity than I ever had in my life, even before cancer.
So happy to hear that.
Yeah, it's
but
cool.
It is such an important story for people to hear. We live in such, it's such a contradiction. Our technology, our medical capabilities are on the one hand amazing, and on the other hand, we get such, I mean, this is a perfect example, horrible treatment. And you have to fight. I guess you have to fight as a patient. Of course, if you're in the black slew of despond and depressed, that's the last thing you're capable of doing.
It's so hard to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
When you're sick.
Yeah.
And when you're physically sick, you're also, you know, miserable.
Right.
I had people helping me along the
way.
Did
you have that's what we need is an ombudsman, isn't it? Somebody to represent our interests.
Yeah, you know, I once heard of somebody, I think I may have interacted with somebody on Twitter who was like she described herself as a cancer doula.
I love it.
Like a midwife for people going through cancer treatment.
I love it.
You know,
that's
I would,
a good
I would
that's
take
a good
that
business.
Up as a profession.
Yeah.
It would just be too re-traumatizing for me.
Yeah, you don't want to do it, but
yeah. But somebody should definitely do that. I had another thing happen really early on in my experience with the cancer treatment system, where like they gave me, this is when they were still trying to figure out the initial extent of my disease and what, you know, was I at stage four, advanced stage four, or stage zero, stage one, stage two, and what kind of treatment and where is the cancer? They gave the wrong scans to me and to my surgeon. And it wasn't just another patient. It was like a guy. You know, something wrong with his junk, maybe. I didn't even have the same part.
I don't see a breast anywhere in there.
Yeah. So there's a whole nother long and funny story to share about how like some hackers and Twitter helped me find an open source app that would allow me to open the file myself without a viewing station at the hospital. And
that's cool.
Nobody wants to deal with that when you're trying to figure out if you're dying or not. But I had just enough support throughout.
Right.
And I feel like my, you know, inquisitive journalism blogger experience helped me network my way and advocate for myself through a system that is so daunting. And if you don't have just enough knowledge to know what you're not getting that you need, you're going to get lower quality care. Yes, money is a big part of it. Like I'm broke as a result of all of that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't rich when I was going through it. So it's a lot of it is, money is a big factor in the quality of healthcare that you get in America, but the ability to understand how the system works, to advocate for yourself, and to ask for support from people who are able to give it, those are things that don't involve cash that can help save your life. There's a big difference between having crappy surgery, like from a half-assed surgeon at a bad hospital, and having the best surgery from the best guy at the best hospital. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a perfect outcome.
No.
Like, I suffer physically every day because of the surgery and treatment that I had. I have chronic pain issues that are a big deal for me every day. The cannabis helps with that. I get a special kind of scar massage therapy that helps with that. But, like, I'm probably way better off than if I'd had a surgeon like who hadn't done thousands of these and wasn't the best in his field.
Right. BCSM, Breast Cancer Social Media Community, is bcsmcommunity.org. And
these women are real heroes.
Having that kind of support, this is one area where technology really does make a difference, because you can have a community that is not geographically proximate. You can find people all over the world, and you can get such great support and information, too. We are at least more empowered to deal with this. We're talking
I was just going to say the relationships that I developed through BCSM are kind of like, you know, and if you're familiar with 12-step programs, yep. It's kind of like having a sponsor almost.
Nice.
These were women who in many cases were just a few steps ahead of me, yeah. Or maybe many steps ahead of me, or maybe like they were just diagnosed just a little bit before me and they've already gone to like the first radiation appointment and they can tell you how it feels or what it sounds like or when you're most likely to have a meltdown.
Right.
And by the way, it's after the treatment ends.
You know, there are communities like this for so many things, for your being a first-time parent, for testicular cancer for men. And it's really worth seeking out those communities. You know, I'm a loner. I hate people. But there are times when you really need the support of people around you. And now, you know, I think, you know, for a long time that was your church. That was, you know, but in this day and age, it might be somebody in Sweden. Right. And it's somebody you meet on the internet. We're talking to Jenny Jardin. She is a journalist. She is an inspiration. Leads Life in Public. Maybe a little more public than you thought today. Thank you, Jenny, for being so public. We're going to take a break. I still want to ask about Calacanis, but first I got to talk about my doorbell.
Yes.
Crazy, but I love this doorbell. Who loves their doorbell? Your doorbell is just a button on the front door. Somebody pushes, and maybe you hear a ding-dong inside. Up till now, the only people I knew who loved their doorbell had funny music playing from it. This is so much better. This is the Ring video doorbell. First of all, I never hear the doorbell, so I was really happy. What this does, by the way, it works with your existing wiring. So I just took the old silly button off, and there were two wires coming out of the door jamb. They give you all the instructions, all the tools, everything you need to do the installation. I'm no handyman, believe me, but I was able to do this myself. And now you've got a new, shiny new doorbell, but with some interesting shiny new capabilities. It's Wi-Fi enabled. It connects to your Wi-Fi. Still rings the chimes in your hall, of course, but now rings the chimes on your smartphone, on your tablet. Everything in the house rings, and even when I'm at work, it rings. There's a camera there, very nice wide-angle camera. There's also a microphone and speakers, so you can answer the door when somebody rings a doorbell. I didn't know this, but they say 95% of all burglaries occur during the day, and the bad guy rings your doorbell to see if you're home. And then if you don't answer, he goes in the back door and breaks in and comes, gets your stuff. There he is. You can see. That's a bad guy. You can tell. Yeah. All you have to do is press the button, even if you're at work, and say, hey, I'm in the other room. What can I do for you? And they leave. They say, oh, no, nothing. So right there, it's huge. But you also have a motion detector. So when people come and go in your area, you can see that. You can go back and look. Now, they give you the first, I think, month of this for free. You can subscribe to it, $30 a year, and it records everything. So if I look at my smartphone or it could be Android or iOS, I can see everybody who's gone and come and gone. So my daughter who sometimes comes in the middle of the night, I could say, Abby, did you come in at 3 a.m. last night? She said, how'd you know? Well, I got the video to prove it. You'll never miss a ring, a ding-ding. It's security, it's convenience, and it's $10 off when you go to ring.com/triangulation. Time Magazine named it one of the top 10 gadgets of last year. It is, I love it. I love the Ring doorbell. There's a funny story because Richard Branson now is a big investor. They just raised, I think, $28 million with a lead from Richard Branson of Virgin. Apparently, the way he found out is somebody was visiting him on Necker Island. And ding, ding, ding on the smartphone. They took out the smartphone. Here they are in the Caribbean and answered the doorbell. And Branson said, what's that? What are you doing there? And he said, well, that's my Ring doorbell. He said, oh, can I find out more about that? It is so cool. Find out more about it. Ring.com/triangulation. $10 off. It's a way of letting them know you heard about this on Triangulation, which we appreciate. And you'll save a little bit too. Ring, RING.com/triangulation. I love my Ring video doorbell. Jenny Jardin is our guest. She's a journalist. You, of course, read her on Boing Boing. She has a Yeti pillow that's unique. She's going to teach me how to make my own tortillas because I went out and I bought 25 pounds of corn, thanks to you. And Mrs. Wales Lime or something like that, something weird. Are you muted? You're muted, Jenny. Unmute her. There we go.
So few people ever tell me that.
Yeah, everybody. You're making everybody in the world. Yeah, mute. Mm. Mute, Jenny. There's a button, you know.
Nobody ever tells me. Please speak more.
I want to hear more. So yeah. Jason Calacanis hires you in your 20s to work for his first publication, the Silicon Alley Reporter. How did you even run into him?
I think this is the way it happened. I was working at a law firm. I had my first like serious enterprise technology job at a law firm in Los Angeles called Latham & Watkins.
Were you like an IT person?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was in, what was it called? It was like enterprise support. It was, you know, basically tech support for a really big law firm.
How'd you know how to do that? Living in Guatemala and everything.
Not like I had worked in, like my first job with computers was when I was in my teens in San Francisco. And I was, I had like a scholarship to 1 year to the San Francisco Art Institute. And when that scholarship ran out, I didn't have the kind of adult support and guidance that I needed to secure more funding or figure out a way to stay in school. So I ended up dropping out.
What were you studying? What kind of art?
Painting and printmaking, which is what my mom and dad did. I actually wanted to go to journalism school, but I got a full ride scholarship.
Nice.
Close to full ride for a year. And it was an expensive school.
It is a very expensive, but a good school. As somebody who, like you, grew up with the smell of linseed oil, and we didn't have a giant letterpress in the living room. We had looms.
Wow, really?
My mom's a weaver and a silk screener.
Oh.
And so I understand very much, and I think, and I cherish it and value it growing up in that environment. And because really, in fact, I remember once saying foolishly, I only want to know artists.
Yeah.
Then I found out, you know what? Everybody has the capability. Everybody's an artist in some form. It's just the media is very, right?
It's true. It's true.
So you didn't get to live your dream as a painter.
You asked me something important.
I want to know how you met Jason.
Oh, yeah. We keep going around Jason and not talking about Jason. I was working in Latham & Watkins. I had wrangled my way into a series of web design jobs when the web was very, very young. And I worked in a web services firm in San Diego County. I moved to San Diego for a while. Like it was hard, thankless work, and it was like a sweatshop. And
God.
I thought that maybe it would be cool to have like a better paying job where there was more structure. So I learned just enough about enterprise IT and VPNs and, you know, encrypting communications between like Dow and the lawyers defending it in the Bhopal case. It was like that level of legal stuff was going on at that firm.
Wow.
They were a big firm that always defend the very, very big bad guys.
That must have been fun.
You know, it was a very sexist, very hostile environment for a young woman who, you know, let's face it, like a lot of us kind of lie and cheat our way into jobs a little bit.
We're
then
all
we
frauds.
Learn on the job.
Yeah.
Everybody does this.
Yeah.
And when you're a young woman, older and more established men in that IT environment, they know what you're doing, and they're very, very hostile, and they hate you.
Yeah.
So I experienced terrible, terrible on-the-job harassment, gender, you know, sexual harassment on the job, and was miserable there.
I imagine you, though, looking a little bit like Elizabeth Salander, the girl with the dragon tattoo.
I wasn't that cool looking.
Oh, shoot.
It's just, but so anyway, I think around that time, there was a lot of cool stuff happening in LA. The first internet bubble hadn't really happened yet. The internet was such a brand new thing. And there was like, what was it? I don't know. It was like some big design show or something that was happening in LA. One of those big annual events. It was like SIGGRAPH maybe or something.
Yeah.
I think maybe it was like at SIGGRAPH that I met Jason Calacanis or something like that. He was hosting a forum that was about some internet thing. I forget even what year this must have been, 90-something. And I came up to him afterwards and said, hey, I think your little Silicon Alley Reporter zine is really cool. Now, if you ever want somebody to write some articles about what's happening in the LA tech scene, I love what you're doing. And we became friends, and I started contributing stuff, and I would write while I was at my miserable job collecting my paycheck, which wasn't entirely honest, but whatever, they were being to me.
You were doing the best you can, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
And I ended up becoming, an editor with him, a regular contributor. And at one point he just said, why don't you just leave your job and just come on board full time? And I really need somebody to help me put together these events. I'd had experience with putting together fine arts tours for a small travel agency. It was one of my early, computer jobs in San Francisco. And so I knew something about creating curated experiences for people, experiences that could cost a lot of money, but where everything is taken care of and you're providing people with a kind of a tour, a kind of a packaged experience. And as it turned out, I was very good at that. And I worked with Jason very closely. We had a very small team. It's a lot like Boing Boing, where people didn't really take us seriously at first. We were very small. A lot of hard working people did. Like, Jason has relatives to this day who are in the restaurant industry or in work as first responders, fire, police in New York City. So he was like, "We need security. I'll just get my brother. I'll get my brother to do security."
That's Jason.
New York Police Department.
Yep.
I think his brother is NYFD. But then he's like, "We're going to need some more d'oeuvres. We only got, $2,500 for meals on these 2 days. My brother Josh, he can make some sushi." Or like, their dad was a restaurateur, I think. So, we need a place to hold the opening night dinner. My dad, he's got this friend. And God bless him, Jason. People get mad at Jason for all kinds of shit, but you can't get mad at him for not having earned it and built it himself in those days. He really, really did. And it was a very exciting, very wonderful thing to be a part of. I was miserable for much of the time because I was working very hard.
He works his people hard. There's no doubt about that.
Very demanding boss.
Yep.
And his goal was not to make you happy and comfortable. His goal was to make money and to, be the the kingmaker.
Right.
And he became that person. And Silicon Alley Reporter became that publication.
Yep.
And we made good money while, really bootstrapping the production. So I learned a lot of good things out of that experience. And, we had, I can remember one of those dinners. It was right after Josh Harris's We Live in Public.
Yes. Josh lived with Jason for a while.
Jason, and I think they remain friends today.
I
certainly feel very friendly towards Josh to this day. He's a very interesting character. And it was right after Josh and his live-in online girlfriend had broken up spectacularly.
On camera.
And you guys can watch the movie.
There's a great movie, yeah.
Great movie. So it was right after that. We were about to launch a big event in New York City, and we had this dinner. And Sergey Brin and Larry Page were two of the guests at the dinner. They arrived, a little later. Like, dinner was mostly over, and people were having drinks. And I remember the first thing that Sergey said when he came in, he was like, "I can't even remember that woman's name right now," but Josh's girlfriend. He's like, "Is she here?"
Yeah,
she's here. So Sergey and Larry wanted to be seated next to her. And the next thing I know, all the vodka's gone, and Sergey is standing on his head and doing circus tricks on the table.
My God. And now, this is early days, right? They're not world famous yet.
Oh, man, this must have been 98 or something, 97.
Yeah.
And Google was just, it was a good search engine.
Yeah.
But it was like the upstart search engine that was going to overtake Hotwire.
Yeah. How fun. You must have so many stories like that.
Many, and cool people like Shaq and Jimmy Page, Ed Koch.
But there's three people you don't normally hear in a sentence together. Shaq, Jimmy Page, and Mayor Ed Koch.
And like Sean Fanning from Napster.
And let's throw in Sean Fanning just to make it more fun. Yeah.
A lot of weird people. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So the last event that I did with Jason, and I think Jason will remember this very well, and Gordon Gould, who was a business partner of Jason's back then, was an event just outside New York City that was going to be about, you know, kind of the it was like Silicon Alley, what was it, 2001. I don't know. Anyway, it was like the spring of 2001 or the summer of 2001. And one cool thing that we were doing with the events at that time was a lot of the content was about internet business, but a lot of it was about bigger stuff in the world. And that was during a time where everybody was so rabid about making money online that the bigger stuff didn't always want to be in the room when you were talking about that other stuff. So one of the other weird sessions for the intellectuals in the crowd was with, I remember I booked this, with Hussein Ibish, the man who was at the time the head of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and this unknown, you know, nobody diplomat named L. Paul Bremer, who was talking about this obscure figure in the Middle East that intelligence was very concerned about at the time, named Osama bin Laden. Mm. And the session was basically about increased surveillance, increased probing of Muslim American communities by federal intelligence in an effort to get a hold on emerging threats in the Mideast, one of whom was this guy named Osama bin Laden, who was tied to previous terrorist incidents, the bombing of the Cole and so on. Everybody knows these stories now, but back then we couldn't get anybody to stay in the seats.
Yeah.
So there was a thing on how to get early stage angel funding or something next door. I remember Hussein Ibish and L. Paul Bremer were on stage arguing about how much surveillance, like, is it okay to surveil mosques in like Dearborn, Michigan, with just regular moms and dads and babies going to worship? How much of that is okay? And I remember Bremer talking about bin Laden with this really intense sense of like gravitas and reserve and urgency that only somebody like Bremer could convey in that very, very restrained, very polished way that you would expect an ambassador to have. Anyway, everybody walked out. And a few months later, Osama bin Laden, everybody knew his name.
Yeah, everybody knew his name.
September 11th.
Yep.
So it was such a fascinating time, and I remain friends with Jason to this day. Even though we haven't worked together since then, I have watched what he's doing with great interest.
We've had our ups and downs, Jason and I, but you know what? You can't stay mad at him, and he's such, and I love him.
Yeah,
you gotta love his energy, his drive, his sense of humor. If you can have people like that in your life, even though they may make you insane, it's great because they stimulate you. They get you going.
You know, there's a saying that somebody taught me last year that I try to use every day. And I think it applies to friendships. Take what you like, leave the rest.
Yeah.
I don't have to. My Rolodex isn't full of like friends who are okay and ex-friends that I hate. It's like, you know, there's people who I'm very close to that at any given moment they might be doing something that really bothers me or that I find unacceptable, but you take what you like, you leave the rest.
We're talking to Jenny Jardin. She's the one of the co-founders of Boing Boing, a journal of wonderful things, which has for more than a decade now kind of enlivened the internet. And whenever I want to just laugh, feel good, be challenged, learn, I go to boingboing.net and I go, yeah. And Cory Doctorow and Mark Fraunfelder. And I actually want to ask you how that started. We got to wrap this up. I'm wasting too much of your time.
Isn't wasted. Time spent with friends is
fun.
Never wasted.
It's really fun. We'll have some final thoughts in just a bit. And I want to ask about Boing Boing. And I want to talk about WoW, because WoW's coming up.
Wow.
Wow. But first, a word from Wealthfront. You know, we're geeks. We like geeky things, right? And sometimes people like us look at the stock market. They look at investments. They look at saving for retirement and think, well, this can be solved algorithmically, programmatically. If only I had the time to do it. Some of us get a little cocky, start day trading, learn lessons fast. You got to save. You got to save for retirement. You got to save to buy that house, that future. You got to save. Everybody knows that. And if you save money, you can't just let it sit in a bank account somewhere. You can't bury it in your mattress. You've got to invest. Now, do you have the time to manage your investments, to pay attention, to do it actively? Maybe not. Maybe you hire an advisor to do that. You know the advisor is going to take between 1 and 3% of your total dollar every year, plus hidden fees for transactions and all sorts of charges. And pretty soon, that money you're making is disappearing. It's getting whittled down. Wealthfront is a clever way to do this. For 0.25% a year, 25 basis points, and there are never any fees, no hidden fees, zero commissions, no additional charges of any kind. Wealthfront uses very sophisticated technology. We love that. To do this investment and does stuff, very interesting stuff like tax loss harvesting and direct indexing that would be hard for an individual to use. Wealthfront is run by and based on books by some of the smartest people like Burton Malkiel, who wrote I read this years ago and was just blown away, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, maybe you've read it, or The Elements of Investing, Charles Ellis, Winning the Loser's Game. These guys have encapsulated really deep insight into how the markets work and written software that will, with your help, make your investments sing. In fact, they are doing so well, they've increased the size of the investments 20 times over the last 2 years. They are now up to $2.6 billion in assets. And it's because of these very sophisticated techniques they're using. This for your personal savings, your joint savings, your retirement. You can do it all at Wealthfront. But here's the deal. You don't have to take my word for it. Go right now to wealthfront.com/triangulation. They're going to walk you through a simple questionnaire that'll gauge your risk tolerance, your time frame, that kind of thing, and give you a sample customized allocation for you, a portfolio, the portfolio they would invest if you were to give them money. Now, you can start with $500. That's the minimum investment. But just for TWIT listeners, if you sign up to invest today, Wealthfront is going to give you your first $15,000 entirely free of charge forever. So forget a quarter of a point. This is 0 points. But even with 0.25% a year, you're getting a great investment tool. And I want to emphasize this, long term. This is for saving for your future. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. And it's nice because you don't have to worry about it. You just let it grow.
For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure.
Wealthfront.com/triangulation. Try it right now. Get that free portfolio. Jenny Jardin, our guest. How did you meet? So Mark Fraunfelder had a zine, like a paper zine called Boing Boing for some time, I think, right?
Yes, that's right. Mark and his wife and creative partner, Carla Sinclair, they began Boing Boing 25 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was a printed zine. They both had other jobs. They both worked at Wired for a while. And this was just something that they did on their own time. It was a printed paper zine during a time, you know, leading out from the whole hardcore punk publishing revolution, where, that was like it was a relic of pre-internet weirdness. You know, those of you who are watching this show, hang on, I'm trying to get my camera straight again.
That's all right.
Those of you who are watching this show who are significantly younger than me will be interested to know that back in the 80s and 90s, people who enjoyed weird offbeat things really had to work at connecting with each other. So zines were a big way to do that. We didn't have Facebook. We didn't have the internet.
Right.
We didn't
right.
have triangulation or the live chat room that's streaming right now as we do this taping.
By the way, they love you.
I don't know if you've seen the chat room. I'm not looking at it because I would be too self-conscious.
It's a very good idea not to look at it.
She's fat. She's ugly. She's dumb.
No. You know, I want to say, well, I'll give you an example. This is from Jean Pierrot. I don't know how you sell it. G-I-M, period, maybe. Pierrot. Jenny is beautiful inside and out. Amazing life journey so far.
You haven't even seen the inside of my stomach. Showed you the x-rays of my intestines yet.
That's next. Hope you'll bring Jenny back more often. She's really sharp and super cool.
That is so nice.
Yeah. For the chat room, it's amazing because you're right. They can be harsh. They're honest.
A little hug from the internet.
Oh, internet hug.
Yeah.
Mark Fraunfelder, who is another guy who I just love and I want to hug every time I talk to him.
So Mark and Carla started this zine during a time when zines were a very revolutionary way to connect with other weirdos in ways that weren't really driven by profit. So it was just a fun hobby. And they were doing that for a long time. Eventually it became too burdensome, too costly to continue publishing as a print zine. And they turned it into a website. And Mark, I think it became a collaborative blog when he needed to go on vacation. And a regular contributor, a guy who kept sending in tips all the time, whose name was Cory Doctorow, he asked Cory if Cory would cover for him when he went on vacation. And Cory was prolific, as he is still to this day.
One of the smartest people. Every time I talk to Cory, I feel so dumb. Do you have that experience? Because I'm just like, oh, okay. I just sit back and go.
Leo, I spent so much of my life feeling like I was dumb that I try not to do that now, but I do think that Cory is very intelligent.
So I'm smart.
Very excited about. He's got this new book that he just announced. Just had a screenplay option by, I think, Paramount. I love seeing my partners become successful in things inside and outside of Boing Boing. We're just loosely knit enough that we get to, we don't get too irritated with each other because we can go do things that we have complete creative freedom over outside of Boing Boing. It's just wonderful and vibrant. We didn't plan it this way, but it worked out this way. So Mark and Carla had been running Boing Boing as a zine. It turned into a blog. It turned into a collaborative weblog. Pasco, I think, was after David Paskovitz came after Cory. He was a longtime friend of Mark, as I recall, and I had met Pasco. I think he actually came to a Jason Calacanis event that I produced. And, gradually the tribe grew beyond that. Eventually we became a business, but it didn't originate as a business. Boing Boing has been around for 25 years, and like as late as I think 2007 or 8, we were arguing at our partner meetings about, do we really want to run a business? Is this really a business, or is this just, like some kind of interesting art project that we care about more than we care about the business? And eventually, we realized it's really great to have a lifestyle business that keeps a roof over your head. Keeps tortillas in the tortilla maker and maybe pays for your kids' college education or for your cancer treatment. And there's a way to do both. And so our struggle has always been around, how do we have a healthy business and a thing that we want to do so much that we can't wait to get out of bed to do? And if somebody came along, as they have, and offered us millions of dollars for the business, we'd say, how much is it worth to pay me to step away from the thing that I love most in the world? Or to give up creative control.
It's ad supported right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do display ads. We have sponsored content where a given advertiser will pay us a certain amount of money to produce features that are related thematically or in some way to their brand. We've done it like with Mercedes-Benz. With Ford. We've done cool stuff with Ford. We do events too. We have an upcoming event, Weekend of Wonder. We are on the day of this taping, I think we are 4 days away from Friday.
It's getting it's September 18th through the 20th at the Mission Inn.
I'll be there. And, Leo, we have a special in-studio guest here at Shenny headquarters who will always be there, also be there.
Don't tell me. Is Chappie here?
Hi!
Chappie, you came home.
Chappie and my mysterious boyfriend who would rather not be on camera.
You said that when you were on Twitter, and I certainly honor anybody And I often say this to my family and friends. I chose to be in public. Doesn't mean you have to be.
That's right.
And I think that's really great. But is it a name that we would recognize, this mysterious boyfriend, or not?
Depends. Depends on where you've been hanging out, Leo.
I love the mystery of it. Anyway, on with the Weekend of Wonder.
Okay, so Weekend of Wonder, September 18th through the 20th, wow.boingboing.net. Mark Frauenfelder and Jason Weisberger, our publisher and co-founder, have really been the ones driving this and putting it together with a publication group called Baby Tattoo. So this guy named Bob Self from Baby Tattoo has put on other weird, cool events at the Mission Inn in Riverside, a really cool 19th century resort in Southern California that's a little bit like the Winchester Mystery House. I think that's up in the Bay Area. And it's just this really cool Spanish-style architecture with all kinds of hidden passageways and catacombs and stuff. We're going to have magic, recreational lock-picking, get-to-know-your-sourdough-starter. Chappie's going to do a little tap dance. We're going to have Andrew Main, who's a
great magician.
Trust Andrew Main star on TV, great magician. We're going to have Stars of Adventure Time there. A guy named John Edgar Park, who's with Disney, who's an Imagineer, who's I think he's actually doing the recreational lockpicking workshop. It's basically a lot of cool, like, fun, family-friendly stuff that we tend to blog on Boing Boing in person. And here, I actually just learned this today. I haven't been to the Mission Inn. Mark and Jason have spent a lot of time there. Oh, David Peskovitz is also going to come to the event.
Oh, nice.
And we're still working on getting Corey there.
Didn't Corey move back to L.A.?
No, he just moved back to L.A.
Oh.
He's got all this stuff going on. We really want to see him and Alice and Posey there.
I know.
So I'm not sure if he's going to make it, but like, we're all bringing our families, our dogs.
Nice.
I might acquire a sheep or a goat, you know, because it's like other women, you know, they bring their Gucci or their Chanel or their Prada.
You bring livestock.
I want to bring livestock.
Yep.
So I will bring something, and it may be livestock, and you should come. It's going to be so fun.
And limited to 100 people. So
very small.
It's going to be, this is like Ted meets Burning Man. I don't know how to describe this. You know, though, I hope this becomes a yearly event because it really sounds great. I can't make it this weekend, but
yeah.
If it does become a yearly event, I will be there next week, next year.
Leo, I actually think that, you know, we just want to, like, we kind of try to do this stuff a day at a time, you know?
Yeah.
We want to see what this turns into.
I honor that, too, about you guys.
The magical thing about working on the internet that we've learned is that once you relinquish the idea that you have to know everything in advance and have to have control, the magic can happen.
Yes.
We want to really have our together and have a beautiful, flawless event, and then let our community, our crowd, our people who have decided to sacrifice their time and their money to come join us, we just want them to have an awesome time and to teach us what the next one should be like. And the last thing I want to say is that our rooms are like all around a central courtyard. This is what I just learned. And the courtyard is ours to use 24/7. So there could be Jason Calacanis could come out there and have a damn poker game.
Sounds like trouble.
Yeah, we have an all-night poker game. And Jason just told me over Slack earlier, he's like, Shenny, when you want to go to sleep, you're just going to have to shut your door.
Oh.
We're like Jason and Pesco and Mark and I and hopefully Corey and my mysterious boyfriend. If you come to this event, you will actually probably meet my mysterious boyfriend. You might even learn his name and you'll probably meet Chappie too.
Nice.
But we're all going to be your hosts there. It's going to be really fun.
I can't wait. Loquacious in our chat room says she'd love Jenny to be a neighbor I could invite over for tea and crumpets and hang out shooting the breeze. Seems so easy to talk to. I thank you for hanging out with. I don't have any tea and crumpets. We have virtual tea and crumpets. But thank you for hanging out with us today.
Oh, thank you, Leo. It made my day.
Oh,
and I'm
so
going to go. I actually think I'm going to go make some tortillas now.
Damn you. Now let me just ask. Okay, you showed us your press. I got the same press.
Yeah.
You said your mamacita said put plastic bags on the top and bottom.
Right. So after you assemble the press, Leo, I suggest that you take some plastic wrap or a little plastic bag from the produce section at the store, and just kind of wrap it and tie it real tightly around the top and the bottom, and that way the tortilla won't stick, and you don't have to worry about oil, flour. Really cool. Yeah, over the weekend, I prepared nishtamal. I took the dried corn, 2 cups corn, 6 cups water, 2 tablespoons of the cal lime, calcium carbonate white powder.
I got it all. Okay.
Yep, put it in a pot, brought it to a slow boil, put the top on, left it there overnight.
It sounds like pozole or something.
It is how you make it. It's the same thing. You're nishtamalizing corn, and in the morning, you put it in a strainer, and then you rub it between your hands under running water, and then you soak it in water in various changes of water until all the debris and that highly alkaline water rub off. And then you can grind it in corn, or you can cook it into pozole, or you can grind it with lard or another fat like coconut oil and make tamales.
Oh, baby!
Yeah.
Will you make a YouTube video or something? Just show us how to do that. Or maybe come back and we'll have a cooking class.
Leo, everybody from like my cancer therapist to, you know, the love of my life here to my mom to our video producer to my partners is saying do a cooking show. And right now, this is just my happy little thing that I do. But eventually it will become something.
Well, I'll be watching. We'll all be watching.
Cool.
Jenny Jardin.
Well, I can't wait to invite you over for dinner, Leo. Thank you so much for having me on. Chappie says hi.
You're a doll. So great to see you. Boingboing.net. Thank you for being here, Jenny.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Take
it's
care.
Really an honor. Bye-bye.
Oh, we do triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. If you watch live, you never know what you'll see. You certainly see the uncensored version of the show, which is great. We might have to bleep it a little bit for download later because we like to make it family-friendly. But I love Jenny's enthusiasm, and certainly if she wants to say anything she wants, it's okay with me. If you don't get to watch live and be in our chat room, well, you can always watch after the fact for any of our shows. They're all available at twit.tv. This show is available at twit.tv/TRI. You can also go to youtube.com/triangulation, and you can download it. Subscribe, really. That's the best idea from iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use, and make sure you get each and every show. We should do Jenny's Kitchen. I have a feeling she has people in L.A. that can help her do that. But, boy, I'll be watching. Thanks for your attendance. Thanks for watching. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, the Jenny fan. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.